Gut. Well, the first one is very clear, and the next one is long. So the first one is, how can we best prepare for death? Well, obviously the best way to prepare for death is to make good use of this life. And the best way to make good use of this life is, first of all, not to create negative karma for next life, to try to create as much positive karma as possible. Then to, as much as possible, stabilize one's practice and one's insight so that at the time of death we are ready to go forward. The important thing to recognize is that we have died so many, many times, so, you know, it's no big deal. We should, at the time, I mean, using our life now as a preparation for death, recognizing we can die at any time. We shouldn't think, oh, when I get to 90, then I'll die. I mean, we can die when we're any age. There is no, just because right now we might be very healthy, doesn't mean that tomorrow we're not going to be dead. I mean, apart from ill health, it can strike anybody, any time. Also, there are many other causes of death. So we can never be sure that we're going to keep living. So the best way to use our life while we have it is to take everything which we do, our family, our jobs, our social life, our practice, all of it, and use it meaningfully. Use it, all that we do, as our Dharma practice. If we from our side are very sincere, I don't mean like being like these nuns here, because they were, you know, nuns. But even as lay people, we can use our lives to benefit ourselves and benefit others, cultivating those qualities of heart, such as generosity, kindness, compassion, empathy, patient endurance, and generosity, and all these qualities which are good, and really trying to look at the roots of those qualities which are negative, like our greed and grasping and our anger and jealousy and so forth, and really try to do something with this life, so that we have moved on a bit, that we have improved at least a little bit from where we started, so that at the time of death, we can feel, I did something useful in this lifetime to benefit myself, to benefit others. I can die without regrets. In addition, on a practical level, we should, if we have any possessions or any wealth at all, make a very clear will. Some people are very superstitious about making wills, but so many families have so much discord as a result of their parents dying and not leaving clear indications or leaving very unfair allocations. So be very fair, make a clear, unambiguous will, so there's no fights when you're gone. And forgive all those who have caused any pain in our life. Let it go. All our resentments, all our blocks. Be at peace with all beings. Just let it go. And be at peace with ourselves too. Forgive ourselves. Let go of our resentments. And be open to all the people who have been with you, your family and so forth. Let them know you love them. But let them go. This is also true for people that when we are with them and they are dying, encourage them to let go. then at the time of death, whatever is our, I mean, if we can die consciously, then of course that is very, very best. I will say that Tibetans are practitioners, the good practitioners, not just Tibetans, because Westerners also who do practice like that, they die really well in meditation and staying in meditation sometimes for hours, days, or even weeks, without the body in any way decomposing. So if we can die as consciously as possible, this is good. But even if we cannot die consciously, we should keep in our mind that to which we have faith. And really from our hearts aspire to be reborn again and to meet the Dharma again as soon as possible without any obstacles. Because what we're thinking of at the time of death very much influences our next life. So we should be very clear that we want to be born in auspicious circumstances where we can meet with the Dharma, have faith in the Dharma, and practice the Dharma as soon as possible. And as you know, in our nunnery, we had all these little nuns coming. And, you know, it was decided that they came so young, so small, some of them 4 years old, and with great devotion when they got there, because they had made these very strong aspirations in past lives to meet with the Dharma as soon as possible and not waste time. So we should all make that aspiration. It doesn't mean you have to aspire necessarily to leave home for homelessness, but at least aspire to meet with the Dharma and with good teachers and with the opportunity to be able to practice as sincerely as possible in all our lifetimes, not just next life, but all our lifetimes, until enlightenment is reached. May I always meet with the precious Dharma, with the precious teacher, and with the opportunities to practice to benefit both myself and others. So in that way, if we use our life now to be of benefit as much as possible, to cultivate the flowers of our virtue and pull out the weeds of our poisonous afflictions as much as we can within our own abilities and the situation we find ourselves in, then we will not have wasted this lifetime. So that's what we need to do, is to recognize we have this precious human birth, we have met with the Dharma, and what we need to do now is to put what we have learned into practice so that at the time of death we can die without regrets. Now this one is very obscure. I mean, I don't know the answer, honestly. In my training, with a strong emphasis on impermanence and emptiness, anatta and shunyata, I fell prey to spiritual bypassing, overriding my fear and trauma until I was so empty, I was a ghost to myself. The pain of that emptiness started waking me up. Can you please address this trap of a kind of bypassing? So he understood the pain of that emptiness by therapeutically understanding the egoistic structures. Well, what can happen if one is not careful is that indeed by emphasizing always non-ego and shunyata, we can fall into a kind of void, which is not the kind of void we are talking about when we talk about emptiness. I think that the way to know when it is good emptiness versus negative emptiness is whether or not the heart is engaged. Because I have met people who tell me how they meditate 10 hours a day, and they are very aware, and you look in their eyes, and it's like looking at a ghost. There's that coldness there, and that total lack of empathy, which shows that they have fallen into like almost a kind of void. And yes, they are not moved by anything, but it's a dead feeling. Genuine realization is the opposite. When we meet with genuinely realized beings, they are more alive than ordinary people. Their eyes are glowing, not only with a sense of deep understanding, but of great compassion and love. Because genuine realization encompasses not just a recognition of this lack of a solid, enduring I, but that lack of a solid, enduring I is covering up that I, that sense of I, the ego, is covering a whole different level of our consciousness, which is completely awake and completely the very nature of deep understanding combined with deep love and compassion. So there's more empathy because the sense of being, of having like a barrier between self and other just dissolves. It doesn't mean we go into some kind of amorphous, but it means that sense of I and other simply doesn't pertain. Therefore, great masters, when you meet them, you know that they know you, they feel you, and with great compassion. So they're more alive, not that they're inwardly dead. And so if in our practice we feel that something inside us is dying in the negative sense, we're on the wrong track. Emptiness doesn't mean a void. It doesn't mean nothingness. It means the open spaciousness of the mind. We're not, normally our minds are very bound. They're very tight. They're imprisoned. And so this is why these nuns keep talking about breaking free, letting down the burden, seeing the light. It's a sense of joy, incredible release. They're not zombies. On the contrary, they are completely alight. This is why the Buddhas and all the Bodhisattvas and Arahats are shown with auras, right? They're shown with light, as if they were from the heart radiating light around them, which draws people to them. People are attracted to them. Whereas if you get into this state of the ego dropping away, but it's not really dropped away, it's frozen, then you get into that state of being frozen. The emotions are frozen, and our sense of empathy with others is frozen. And then it's like being in a cold, dark place, not dark, but cold and empty place, which is not comfortable, which is not joyful, which is simply, as they said, you're inwardly you're empty but dead. And that is very not at all what we're talking about. To drop the ego is a sense of release and spaciousness, and then it allows all our innate qualities of our deeper being to come forward, which is love, which is wisdom, which is joy, which is light. So that when we meet with genuinely realized beings, we feel that. When I first came to India back in the sort of early 60s, mid-60s, the Tibetans had just come out of Tibet. They were still very destabilized because they had lost everything. And now they were in this totally new country, different climate, different food, different customs, different temperature. Everything was different. They'd lost everything. It was a great equalizing. There was no high and low. Everybody was together as refugees. And so fortunately for Tibet, for Tibetan Buddhism, many of the great masters had also left. Not all of them. Many were left in Tibet and went into prison, but many of them did leave. And so when one met them at that time, they were not yet established in big, beautiful monasteries sitting on high thrones. They were still very, very simple in very, very simple accommodation. And they didn't know English, and none of us knew Tibetan. And so we couldn't do much. You just sat there, and they'd sort of give you a cup of tea. But the feeling that all of us felt was, this is it. There is our human potential. That is what we are aiming for. Just sitting there quietly. Not saying anything. But you didn't need to say anything. It's like the Hindus have the idea of going to see the guru and you have darshan. Like you just sit there. Guru doesn't do anything, he just sits. And you just sit. And it's very beautiful. Because you don't have to come up with brilliant questions. You don't have to be sparklingly witty. You don't have to do anything. You just sit there and absorb. But our feeling was, that is an enlightened being. Just there. They didn't say anything. They didn't do anything. But just, we knew that there was the fullness of wisdom and compassion sitting there. There was total sanity right there. So that is what we're aiming for. The mind completely healed, finally. So if we feel that that is not what is happening, if we feel that somehow we're losing empathy, that we're entering something which isn't vibrant and clear, then we should be careful. Because that can lead to a lot of psychiatric problems. It's not the way. This is why also the Buddha emphasized, I think, the cultivation of loving kindness and compassion and so forth, to balance any tendencies to go in that way when one is doing very strict vipassana, for example. To engage the heart. So it's very important to look and see, are we becoming kinder? Are we becoming more peaceful and more alive? Are we becoming more clear? Are we becoming more empathetic towards people that we meet or not? If we are creating a glass wall, then that's the wrong way. Sometimes, I mean, people I meet are a bit like that. They've done lots of meditation and it's created like, you know, a wall around them. And that's not the way at all. If one meets genuine practitioners, they are more warm, more loving, more kind, more clear. Not less. Can you talk a little about reincarnation, what reincarnates? Soul, atoms? Was the Buddha a god or a mortal? He was not a god. He denied being a mortal. Of course, he was a man. He was just asked at one time after his enlightenment if he was human. And he said, they said, are you a god? And he said, no. And they said, are you human? And he said, no. And they said, what are you? And he said, I'm a Buddha. But of course, he was a human being, but he had just realized the total human potential. So he went out of the ordinary mundane level of what we think of as humans. That's why he said he wasn't a human. So reincarnation, well, what reincarnates basically is our consciousness, not the surface consciousness, but the stream of our consciousness. In Buddhism, the idea of something static within us, something which is immutable, individual, me, unchanging, that sense of I that we have at the center of our being, that from a Buddhist perspective is our fundamental ignorance or unknowing. It's that which blocks us from recognizing our true nature, which is so much vaster than anything which we can imagine with our little sense of individual I. So, I mean, that, you know, to realize the nature of the mind is to realize nirvana. It's not something which is, as I keep saying, it's not something out there. It's something inside us. Nirvana is within us. As long as we don't recognize it, we're in samsara. Once we do recognize it, then we start to go on the journey to transformation. But it's all within us already. This is why the nuns could get it like that. They didn't have to create it. Nirvana is our true nature. It's with us the whole time. We just don't see it. So what reincarnates is our consciousness, a stream of consciousness, which is like a river flowing. It's always flowing, flowing, flowing. It never stops. And at the same time, the karma, which we have created in this and previous lives, like seeds sown in a huge field, that also goes along with us, so that we are the result of actions of body, speech, and mind, intentional actions of body, speech, and mind, which we have created in this lifetime and in past lifetimes. So we always have our moment to moment eating up our past karma and creating through our responses our future karma. So moment to moment in the present is this crossroads. How we respond to what is happening to us is creating moment to moment our future, and at the same time we are eating up our past. So, and along with that comes some habitual propensities. So that means that things which we do again and again in this lifetime, how we respond, that also colors what will happen in next life. For example, when you have small babies, some babies are very sweet little babies, all happy giggle, even when they're tiny. And some, you can see already, they have, you know, they're not happy, or they're angry, or they have, some are very musical people, some people are very artistic, some people are good at sports, some people are intelligent, some people are stupid. It depends on, partly on our karma, and partly on the habitual tendencies which we are created in past lives. So, for example, in this lifetime, if we are very musical and we spend much of our time playing music, then it's likely that in our next lifetime we will have a predisposition towards being musical. So it's not I. Because if we met ourselves in our past life, we wouldn't know who's that. And if we saw ourselves in our future lives, we wouldn't recognize ourselves. It's not me that goes on. It's this stream of consciousness and all the karmic imprints which follow us lifetime after lifetime. So in each lifetime, we don't know. Gender, race, nationality, human or not human, depends on what we did in this lifetime now and the karmic results of what we did in this and past lifetimes. So people hold so tightly to the idea of gender and nationality, race, but it's all transitory, changes. We don't know what we're going to be next time. This is why it's important to make aspirations to always meet with the Dharma. Because the chances of meeting with the Dharma, especially in the world today, you know, unless we really direct our aspirations in that direction, it doesn't mean that next time we will meet up with the Dharma. So we have to, from our side, make very strong, you know, sort of like prayers, really, that we can again and again and again be in a position where we can practice and benefit beings through wisdom and compassion in all our lifetimes. There is a lot of unethical conduct coming to light in the Buddhist community right now. How do you find a teacher? How do I find a teacher? Don't all teachers have some faults given the nature of samsara? What faults should I accept in a teacher? Yes, well, of course, there is a lot of unethical conduct coming to light, and as not just in the Buddhist community, but in many religious communities and throughout the world, of course, because humans are humans. Somebody said there is Buddhism, and then there are Buddhists. So don't confuse the two. How do I find a teacher? Well, you know, one has to be discriminating. There are very, very excellent teachers out there. Because there is some unethical conduct which is quite rightly being exposed, that doesn't mean that all teachers are unethical. The vast majority are not. The vast majority are very trustworthy. And so don't be, you know, it's like the news. When you read a newspaper, it's full of bad news, but that doesn't mean the whole world is bad. There's a lot of goodness there, but they don't mention that bit because that's not exciting. So we hear a lot about all the things which have gone wrong, but we don't hear, because nobody reports on it, all the things which are right. As to choosing a teacher, this, I think, is a very karmic matter. You can't say that this teacher is the right one for everybody, because, you know, just as different people fall in love with different people, likewise, someone who is a good teacher for one person might not be a good teacher for another person. It's a very individual thing. I would say, first of all, do not be caught up in charisma. Many people are very charismatic. It doesn't mean that they're enlightened. Mao Zedong was charismatic. Hitler was charismatic. So don't be caught up. Also, don't be caught up too much by the physical appearance. I mean, somebody said they chose their lama because when he smiles, he has cute dimples. Well, I mean, he was fortunately a good lama too, but apart from his dimples. That is not his physical appearance, apart from that he should have a benign appearance. It should not be... anything. Also, gender. Different people are attracted by male teachers or female teachers, or both. There's also the question that we don't need to have just one teacher. We can have many teachers. The Dalai Lama himself says he has 25 teachers, and he puts them all on his refuge tree. So, be discriminating. I would say don't be naive. Look at the sangha around that teacher. Do you like these people? Is that how you want to be, looking at their senior students? Is there harmony in that sangha? Do they seem like they've actually learned something? Just get the feel of it. I mean, just because we go to a center and we get some teaching doesn't necessarily make that person your teacher. In the tantras, it is said that we should examine the teacher up to 12 years before accepting them. So even though this is not, you know, from an ordinary point of view, we don't need to go to such extremes. Nonetheless, is that teacher qualified? What is their lineage? How much practice have they actually done? You know, there are very good teachers out there. And look around. I mean, there's no way you can point and say, yes, that's the teacher, everybody should go to him or her. But, you know, shop around. I mean, some people choose teachers with less discrimination than they choose their favorite jar of yogurt. They just go for somebody just because, you know, and they don't discriminate. And sometimes it goes okay, sometimes it doesn't go okay. So, you know, use your common sense. And in the meantime, we can learn from many people. They don't all have to be enlightened. If somebody knows more than we do, then already that they've got something to teach us. I mean, we don't have to, if we're wanting to learn to play the piano, we don't have to have Rubinstein as our teacher. You know, we can just get the local teacher. She's already done, you know, she's done her work. She knows how to play enough. She might not be at Carnegie Hall, but she's okay. Like that. So all our teachers don't have to be, you know, super enlightened, arhatism, eighth level bodhisattvas. But they should be trustworthy. Their motivation should be to help the student, not their own self-inflation. This is important. If their motivation is pure, based on their compassion and their desire to share and help, then it's a good teacher. Provided they have some knowledge of what they're talking about, obviously. I mean, they have to be further along. But nonetheless, within that, you know, the main point is that we should trust. And they should be worthy of trust. Trust to lead us on the right path and give the kind of instruction which we need. Then? So he says, don't all teachers have some faults given the nature of samsara? Sure they do, they're people. So what? Depends what the faults are. Seducing students is not an acceptable fault. Preferring lots of cups of coffee to herbal tea could be allowable. If lamas and arahats view women as inferior, doesn't this mean that awakening does not include seeing through one's cultural conditioning? It's an interesting point, because in all Buddhist countries, although it has produced very enlightened beings, still the situation for women has been very unbalanced. There is no doubt, you can't make excuses. And so indeed, people do ask, well, with all that wisdom, where was their understanding and their compassion? And I honestly don't really know what the answer is. It is social conditioning. And the lamas now are admitting that it is social conditioning. That somehow or other, through the centuries, indeed the millennia, women have been unintentionally overlooked, as somebody remarked to me, with apologies. So why they unintentionally overlooked women for so long, I don't know, except that that was the social customs. One time I asked my Lama Kamtar Rinpoche how it was that there were so few female reincarnate lamas in Tibet, so few tukus. And he said that at the time of her birth, his sister had more signs than he had had at the time of his birth. In Tibetan Buddhism, often a sign of a special being being reborn is the signs at the time of birth, like rainbows or flowers falling from the sky or the water in the offering bowls turning to milk and this type of special birds singing, this type of thing. They're signs. And so he said his sister had more signs at the time of her birth. And so when everybody got very excited, whoa, who's coming? And then when it was a girl, they'd say, whoops, mistake. And that was it. He said if she'd been a boy, they would have been very careful, tried to find out who he was an incarnation of, taking very good care of him, so he was properly trained. Because it was a girl, then she was ignored. She just grew up in the family, uneducated. In time, she was married off. He said sometimes these women later, when their families left home, went up into the caves and meditated and gained great realizations. But because they were not educated and trained, their ability to benefit many was very limited. He said, for that reason, from a social point of view, it was not auspicious to be reborn as a woman. But why any of these lamas then didn't say, this is not right, let's do something, I don't know. I mean, some of them did. The first Sognyu Rinpoche, some of you might have met Sognyu Rinpoche, he comes to America a lot. The first Sognyu was told by his lama to start a nunnery for yogini nuns. And so he did so. I mean, he was horrified at the time, I think. What, nuns? Hmm? But then he started this very, very special nunnery, which is even going to today, where all the nuns are trained to be yoginis. They all sit in meditation boxes. They never lie down. And they're very expert in the inner heat, tummo meditations. And even to today, they are there practicing. And so the lamas who are associated with that monastery are all very, very enthusiastic about female potential for practice. But nonetheless, even then, the outreach from the nuns themselves is limited because at the same time they are not very educated. So it's, I don't know why they never realized there was a problem, but they didn't. Until now. So, it seems Dharma and Sangha don't necessarily offer protection from shared societal ignorance. How to practice in order to uproot shared yet unknown harmful views and actions? Really, sweetheart, just practice. Look at your mind. I mean, this is what we all have to do. We cannot change society while our own minds are a projection of what is wrong in society. You know, we go around telling everybody else how they should be, but we cannot even control ourselves. So first, you know, we have to make our own mind peaceful, clear, and to recognize the negative, afflictive emotions and try to transform them or uproot them within ourselves. And from that, to then reach out towards society. But as long as we are trying to change society and ourselves are still in the grip of all our heavy negative emotions, then it just creates more and more confusion and doesn't really solve the problem. Doesn't mean we just have to sit on our meditation cushions and do nothing to help society. But at the same time, we should do it with an awareness and from the root of our compassion rather than from the root of our outrage and anger and so forth, which just creates more outrage and anger. Do you see what I mean? I mean, I would say someone like Thich Nhat Hanh, for example, with his protests in Vietnam and later for peace and so forth, he always emphasized it has to be done from the inner state of what we are seeking for on the outside. So if we are looking for peace, we have to have peace to offer. If we are still in a state of conflict and anger, how can we talk about peace? It won't come. Because we are just projecting out our own anger and saying peace. And that just hits the person, the people that we are trying to convert to our idea of peacefulness with anger. I mean, if we think I'm right and you therefore you're wrong, then how can there be any reconciliation? So within ourselves, we have to embody something at least of those qualities which we would like to see embodied in the rest of the world. Otherwise, we just create more and more conflict, more and more problems. This is why the world doesn't really move upward. You know, it doesn't really transform because the people in control are themselves out of control, as we can see. Who is controlling this world? Certainly not people who have, you know, tamed their minds. What is the point of being in a body if the teachings are training us to renounce it? Yes, but we can't get anywhere without a body. So it's not that the renouncing the body doesn't mean we commit suicide. But it means, in this case, that we are not fascinated by our bodies. And we don't identify ourselves with our appearance. We use the body. We keep it healthy, we exercise it, maybe we try to eat fairly healthy foods without being obsessive. But in the end, we are not the body. The body we're going to leave behind. In the text, it said the body is like a hotel. Right? You inhabit it for a while and then you leave it. Well, you know, you don't get too attached to your hotel. It's only a hotel, for God's sake. You don't have to spend all your time and money decorating your hotel room. Isn't it? So a hotel is very useful. We are grateful for hotels on our journey. But we don't get over-attached to them and identified with them. It's only a hotel. The important thing is the consciousness inhabiting that hotel. I mean, in the meantime, you don't beat up the hotel, right? You don't trash it because it's not mine, right? I mean, you leave it neat and tidy, but... This morning you spoke briefly about the notion of this life being precious, even if our bodies are sacks of blood and guts. Could you say more about that? Yeah, of course our lives are precious. Goodness me. Of all the billions of beings inhabiting this planet, how many have a human body? Human body means also human intelligence. Of all the human beings on this earth, how many have the kind of education allowing you to think clearly, to analyze, to discriminate that you have all received here in this room? Of all the beings in this universe, how many have met with the Dharma? And out of all those who have met with the Dharma, how many have faith? Out of all those who have faith, how many are willing to practice? The fact that you are sitting here in this room right now, whether or not you think it was a mistake, is because, of causes and conditions which you yourself have created. And those causes and conditions of meeting with the Dharma and having an interest in the Dharma are very rare, even in this world right now. Even most people in Buddhist countries, born as Buddhists, from Buddhist parents, surrounded by temples, monks and nuns, most of them have no interest. Most of them don't want to practice. In the West, in America especially, you say Buddhist and people think meditation. But that's not true in Buddhist countries. Most people in Buddhist countries think Buddhism, going to the temple, making offerings, feeding monks, making merit. They don't think meditation. Very few Buddhist countries encourage widespread practice. Even in Thailand, I went down to this monastery, a big monastery in the south, and there were over 100 people all doing a Vipassana course. Every single one was Western. It wasn't a single Thai there. So, this lifetime, having all these causes and conditions coming together, that you have a human birth, that you have met with the Dharma, you have the freedom to believe what you want and to practice what you want. It is very rare. Don't take it for granted. This is why this is a precious human birth. Not any old human birth is precious, but a human life with all the freedoms and opportunities, and especially the ability to meet with the Dharma, have an interest with the Dharma, meet teachers who are teaching the Dharma and can give guidance. That is very, very, very rare. If we waste it now, it probably won't come back for many, many lifetimes. This is why this lifetime is so precious. And we shouldn't take it for granted. Okay, so I guess this goes with this, sorry. Didn't monks meditate on the disgusting qualities of the body, female, primarily as a way of controlling lust? Yes, they did, and they didn't. The problem was that they still projected the idea that the female was lustful. And they didn't like the idea that maybe their was their problem, not hers. But of course, yes, the idea of seeing the female as disgusting was a way of controlling lust. But it also gave rise to aversion and the idea of the superiority of the male body, because they were no longer regarding the male body as impure. They were regarding the female body as impure. Now, this is not what the Buddha taught. The Buddha taught that the monk should look at his own body, just as these nuns were looking at their own body, and lose his attachment and fascination with his own body, because if we lose fascination with our own body, then also we lose fascination with the bodies of others. So it wasn't to create aversion or a sense of superiority. I'm pure, she's impure. But that's how it got twisted almost. So that again, the male could feel themselves superior. And that it was the female who was impure. And of course, this plugs into the Indian mentality, which sees the female as impure, especially because females have monthly periods, and because they give birth to babies, which is messy, and so therefore they are regarded as being impure. And so in many temples, women are not allowed to go. Only males can go. And a while back in a newspaper, I read how one wife, when she had her monthly periods, she was locked in like a shed. And because it was so cold and she was not even given blankets, she died of the cold. Her husband every month would just lock her in the shed. So this idea, because he didn't want her polluting his house, right? So this idea that the female is impure and the male is pure got, I think, translated into this meditation, which wasn't what the Buddha said. But the idea then, right, it was safe to look on the impurity of the female, and that doesn't touch my own innate perfection as a monk. So this was the problem, that it created this not just fear of the female, but aversion to the female and a sense of superiority. That was where it went wrong, even though the idea was just merely to lessen their own lust. Humans being what they are, what is the experience of ordained Buddhist nuns who identify as gay or lesbian? Well, you know, once you're a nun, you're a celibate, so who cares what your sexual orientation is? It's irrelevant. You're giving up sex of any variety in your thoughts as well as your actions. So therefore, it's irrelevant. Who cares? Could you please give some guidance on how to work with the body and senses in a way that doesn't develop either desire or aversion? Well, you know, the thing is just to be mindful. If one is mindful of one's body, and if one is mindful of the sense doors and contact, one has neither aversion nor desire. One sees these as they arise, and in seeing, they can dissolve again. And then in that way, one is completely poised within a state of present awareness. And then there is no aversion and there is no attachment. There just is. Pure awareness is not attached or against anything. It just sees things as they really are. So in that state, we don't have to reject the body, we don't have to be attached to the body. We just know the body. It's very simple. The problem is we don't do it. In itself, the body is not good or bad. It's very useful. We use it. But we're not used by it. That's the difference. When we get obsessed about our bodies, identify with our bodies, then there's a problem. But as long as we respect our bodies and use our bodies for the sake of benefiting many beings, including ourselves, and for practicing the Dharma, then there's no problem with the body in itself. The body is innocent. The body isn't the problem. The mind is the problem. Our attachment to our body is the problem. That is not the body's problem. That is our mind's problem. So all this going on about, you know, the unpleasant nature of the body is not for the body. We're not beating ourselves up. We're not flagellating or fasting or standing on one leg endlessly in order to subjugate the body. But we're losing our fascination. Body is very nice, very useful. But as I said, it's just a hotel room. When we go into a hotel, we take the amenities, but we don't, you know, we leave it as nicely as we came into it. We don't need to be attached to it. Some hotels are very nice, some hotels are less nice, but it's just a hotel. In If the pleasures of the senses are strong poisons, like a disease, etc., Sumedha says, why bother with art and music? Well, that's a good question. I think in the Theravadin tradition, they are not, they don't play music. In other traditions, sometimes they do. Again, it depends whether one is applying one's senses in a mindful manner or not. Certainly, even in the Theravadin countries, there is a lot of emphasis on very beautiful art, especially religious art. And sometimes monks themselves were artists. It was a way of developing concentration and devotion and of benefiting many beings if they were skillful. And so if one, even in Theravadin countries, what to speak of China and Japan and Tibet, there is a great deal of art, religious art, which is very, very beautiful. And this was, sometimes the artists were lay people, often they were monks. And so art is a way of lifting the heart. Beautiful art is the way of lifting the heart. And so, therefore, also in Christian circles, they use art and music, of course, in a way of lifting the heart to create great devotion. In the Tibetan tradition, they also have very beautiful songs of devotion, mostly devotion to the Lama or devotion to like the Buddha of compassion or to Tara. These sounds reach to a deeper level of our psyche than the ordinary conceptual thinking, as we know, which is why great music moves us very deeply. It moves us at a deeper level than our conceptual thinking mind. And so this can be used skillfully to arouse great devotion and a sense of a spacious, open appreciation. So great art and great music, it can be useful on the spiritual path. It's a way of taking our senses and exalting them instead of simply distracting them. And so in all Buddhist countries, therefore, there is art, and in many there is also beautiful music. Our nuns sing some very beautiful music, actually, and it's very touching. As I say, you know, pure devotional singing, as in the Sufis, for example, and the Hindus, and all of them, and the Christian religious music is extraordinary. Some of it is just so deep. And it makes use of a deeper level of our consciousness than is reached through mere intellectual or verbal application. It music does reach to a very deep level, there's no doubt. So I think we are now here. Those I did with, these I didn't. So we use this tomorrow. Tomorrow we have no questions and answers, I'm told. But maybe on the last day we will, in the morning, no?
Maybe, yes, we can work that
in. We can do, spend some time answering any questions which are specially applicable, if you wish. Okay? Because tomorrow it might be that we actually get through quite a lot of the text.